Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you're all doing great. Thanks for the kind words and the notes that you've sent by email. I don't have any questions that some of you have asked, but we have a time that we can discuss any clarifications from the first three seminars. We're going to talk about neuromarketing in this seminar. So are there any questions or clarifications or things that might be helpful to elaborate a bit about from any of the first three seminars? Okay, I want to respond to an earlier question, and this was one sent by email by someone who was not able to attend last time, basically asking if proven evidence changes beliefs, and how much should we indicate in marketing or in discussion of somebody about products or services about the evidence that and facts. Basically, what we know is proven evidence doesn't change beliefs. Facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in our brains. You don't change a belief or what someone believes as fact by suddenly introducing a new idea and expecting it to override the one that's already there. Facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions or to market products or services. Data is not a way to change mind. It's simply not how we decide. Established beliefs are really resistant to change, even when there's scientific evidence to disprove them. In fact, people regard information as valid evidence when it reinforces what they already believe, their existing views. This is how, and this is a paradox in a way, this is how arguments more staunchly solidify an original position. In other words, presenting somebody with information that contradicts an opinion that they have causes them to generate new counterarguments that further strengthens their view. You've probably seen this. It's called the boomerang effect. So what happens is that people grow more confident and more definitive in their initial convictions, and they use information to polarize opinions. And you see this regularly in major things like abortion, gun control, climate change. So we quickly accept evidence that confirms our preconceived notions, and we assess counter evidence with a critical, even disbelieving eye. Then we cherry pick information to sort of fortify our beliefs without even being consciously aware of it. In fact, more recent studies have shown that the more intelligent people are, the greater their ability to creatively rationalize and interpret information to fit their opinions. In other words, the brighter you are, the more you'll have a boomerang effect to have arguments solidify a point of view. So what do you do then to change beliefs? Which is is there a question? I'm hearing some sounds in the background. Any questions any of you have? If you have any sound going on and you're not ready to ask a question or comment, would you mute, please? Or I can go to lecture mode, but I wanted to have a little bit of a discussion initially. What we know from neuroscience and what parents of teenagers have known for centuries is that the first word spoken trigger a neurochemical reaction in the listener to boot up a specific mindset. This is conversational intelligence. That mindset then processes the remainder of the conversation to determine meaning and significance. In other words, a conversation that begins with remarks that are perceived as authoritative or critical or adversarial activates the brain's defensive circuitry of fight, flight, or freeze, and that processes the remainder of the conversation. So the listener then closes down or gets self-protective. Now, consider a different beginning, a conversation that begins in a collaborative mode, activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system related to bonding and connection. This initial perception of a collaborative, trusting discussion really induces a desire to listen without judgment, to pay full attention to the speaker, and frames the remainder of the conversation because the listener feels safe and heard and understood. Trust can then develop with further collaboration to optimize performance and results. Think about how this is an application of the circle technique. You resonate with that stick figure in the circle and create a common ground together and then proceed together to go to a new place. The collaborative mindset, the resonance with the challenge, with the experience of the individual, is a place that began, and then you proceed together in a different way. Any comments or thoughts or questions that would be helpful for us to discuss? If not,
Dr. Kruger. Hi. This is Catherine Zabinski, and I do apologize. I did miss last week as well, but I do have a question about week three and what you were talking about. So, is that imperative, or maybe not imperative, is not the word, but beneficial, that we reach others' value systems, and not so much that we're trying to convince, but really collaboratively help them to see the benefit, and we need to reach into their value system as the same, not trying to change it, but we need to know what their value system is. Does that make sense?
Yes, it totally makes sense, and it adumbrates exactly what we're going to be talking about in this seminar. And first of all, you couldn't change it if you wanted to, but it's so important to really resonate and appreciate what the client wants and needs and what their values are, because people buy what they identify with. They buy according to their identity, or they sign on to do something that fits with their identity. So we're going to elaborate that, but that really succinctly summarizes an important aspect, and we want to know what's in it for them. What is their benefit? What do they want and need that they aren't able to do or be by themselves? Because that's what we offer, whether it's coaching services, whether it's product, it's something that we're offering that they can't do or be by themselves, that they want and need, but we need to know what they need, what they want, what their values and ideals are, because people don't buy outside their values, their ideals. You buy according to what you identify with, what is fundamental and core to your identity. And we talked a bit about this in last seminar, that neuroscience labs are able to see from a brain perspective when someone focuses on something that is part of their identity, that's part of their sense of self, that part of their brain lights up, and that determines a purchase decision. So that's some of the things we want to know. So we're going to talk about more about how to do that during this seminar specifically on neuromarketing. So great question.
Okay.
And it really
sets
up our discussion. Yeah. I'm going to put us on lecture mode and hold on to any questions or comments for a brief discussion at the end. Okay, this is the quiz I mistakenly gave you the very first seminar. Wharton School of Business surveyed several thousand professionals to look at the major factor that determined whether someone engaged or whether they declined services from the professional. And it was the same reason that someone would most decline or most accept. So what do you think was most important? Years of experience, reputation, amount of fee, degrees and certifications, stating the recommendations and fee clearly and confidently, or state of the economy? Hold on to your answer. So here are four questions to consider. Each is a yes or no, and I'm going to tell you quickly what the answers are. Jot down your immediate answers to these questions, and these are in your outline. One, this is a yes or no, just a quick yes or no. Do you earn your living by offering others goods or services? Do you work for yourself or run your own operation, even if part-time? Just yes or no. Does your work require elastic skills, the ability to do a variety of different functions through the day? And lastly, do you work in education, training, human resources, or healthcare? If you answer yes to any one of these four questions, you're in sales and service. If you're a doctor, attorney, accountant, consultant, coach, or business professional, you're in sales and service. To deliver a fantastic experience to your prospect is the best sales strategy that there is. Neuromarketing simply integrates biological and social sciences to understand unconscious choices and the underlying brain activity that determines those choices. When we engage potential prospects with a product or service, we invite them to part with their resources, including time, attention, effort, and money. If they do, we'll bring value and they'll benefit from the engagement. Teachers sell their students that the science lesson they're teaching is interesting and beneficial. In healthcare, the physical therapist helps someone recover from injury to handle resources, time, attention, and effort, because patients can be healthier if they use those resources wisely. What we know, to move people effectively and powerfully requires seeing them as a participant and a collaborator. This is a unique framework to professional coaching, and it distinguishes coaching from all other professions. Here's what happens when you don't do that. When people see a physician, fewer than 50% who get a prescription from this expert consultant actually fill it. Of those who do fill it, just under 50% take it as directed. So when someone is motivated by fear and pain, inconvenience by time and travel, and have to pay to consult an expert, less than 25% actually follow that expert advice. Here's the key. It doesn't become their story. So consider this question for yourself and write down a specific number as you hear the question. What percent of your real work time is informing, convincing, or persuading people to give up something they value for something you have, something that will bring them great value? Over 10,000 professionals around the world were surveyed to address this question. Almost everyone considered this aspect a crucial component of their success. Yet, while the vast majority believe that direct persuasion is essential for professional success, the time allotted to engaging and directly persuading people was in the very low single digits. What we find valuable and what we actually do may really be different. When we work for ourselves as entrepreneurs, we become salespeople as well. What people in sales do is to move people. Do you know how you can tell the ones who don't do this? They're the ones with really skinny kids. The persuasion industry, now informed by neuromarketing, focuses on most everything we buy, what we purchase for emotional reasons and then justify by logic, is shaped in ways so subtle that we may fail to recognize them. Here's an example of a failure in influence. A cigar manufacturer spent considerable money on an advertisement that depicted a beautiful, smiling woman handing out cigars to her husband and his friends. This was attractively produced in an elegant English library setting and widely distributed. The result? A dramatic fall in cigar sales. They were baffled initially. But when men smoke cigars, they unconsciously feel dominant and important. By showing a woman encouraging a man to smoke and being subservient to her offering, the advertisement psychologically countered the male customer's intent. So let's consider now some common misconceptions about selling. For 3 years in a row, my good buddy Art Wilson was the number one salesperson in IBM's group of over 10,000 healthcare sales professionals before he moved to a senior executive position there to train the IBM sales force. Then he took an early retirement to start his own hugely successful consulting firm, working with the sales forces of multinational corporations. And just looking at him, you would never guess he was in sales. He's a big, gentle, laid-back, lovable guy, kind of like me. In researching this material, I asked him if there were common misconceptions about selling. Here are the two biggest misconceptions that he passed on. One, selling is a natural gift. For more than 90% of people, including the most successful salespersons, this is not true. Someone may do the right thing for the right reason, but it has to be combined with the right style and emotion. It's an art and a science with its own developed body of knowledge and practice. Second misconception, the best salespeople have no call reluctance. Way over 90% of the best salespeople regularly have call reluctance. I said, Art, why didn't you tell me this when we started? But they do anyhow by getting the optimum state of mind and sticking to their plan. Pick people you want to reach out to and do it. You don't have to be motivated, but you have to have a plan and stick to it. Shrink the change, your designated number of contacts per day. From a number of conversations and interviews with outstanding sales professionals, these two questions form the heart of the sales exchange. If the person you're selling to agrees to buy, will his or her life improve? Two, when your interaction is over, will the world be a better place than when you began? If your answer to either of these questions is not yes, you need to recalibrate. It's said that marketers often make these mistakes, assuming people are rational, assuming people are eager for change, and assuming that once somebody knows things the way you know them, they'll want to choose what you choose or offer. None of those are true. Remember, it's what you think you already know that will most prevent you from learning. Professor Harold Coe teaches law and emphasizes that in an attempt to understand the law, or in understanding just about anything, the key is to focus on the 1%. To not get lost in the details, but to think about the essence of what's really important, the 1% that gives life and meaning to the other 99%. Understanding that 1% and especially being able to explain it to others is the hallmark of a strong position. The 1% is the essence of simplicity and clarity. Whether you're selling a product or a service or hoping to convince anyone of anything, what's the 1%? When you can answer that question clearly, briefly, simply, in 10 words or less, and convey it to others, you and they are most likely to be moved. Einstein said, if you can't state your position simply, you don't understand it well enough. Seth Godin doubled down to Einstein and said, if you can't state your position in 8 words or less, you don't have a position. The purpose of a 1% is not necessarily to move someone else to adopt your idea. The purpose is to offer something so compelling that it begins a conversation. The measure of success after your statement is when the other person says, tell me more. That isn't a license to start talking in paragraphs, only to have the next 10, the second set of 10 words or less, as carefully crafted as you do your first 10. The other person begins being a participant to effectively arrive then at an outcome that both of you are guided by your conversation, that appeals to both of you. You engage the co-creation of a new story rather than handing someone a prescription of information that they're not going to fill. To articulate your 1%, consider three common types of value propositions. First, the one-word pitch. What is the one characteristic that you most want associated with your name, your business, your brand? A one-word equity. When anyone thinks of you, they associate that word. When anyone says that word, they think of you. For me recently, it was to make up a word, NeuroMentor. It amalgamated psychology, neuroscience, and mentor coaching. I liked it enough that I trademarked it and initiated the first of a new series of online offerings and renamed my blog. Now, some other examples, each to date are just a little more famous than NeuroMentor. What technology company do you think of when you hear the word search? What credit card company comes to mind when you hear the word priceless? Well, Google and MasterCard. In his 2012 re-election campaign, President Obama built his entire strategy around one word, forward. Two is the question pitch. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was running for president in a very grim economy. Reagan simply asked a question, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? The question was designed to make people come up with their own reasons for agreeing or not. When people come up with their own answers for agreeing or believing something, they endorse the belief more strongly and become more likely to act on it rather than simply adopting your belief or you ghostwriting their story, because it becomes their story. That's why the people who didn't respond to the expert recommendations of a physician, it was the physician's story. It wasn't the patient's story. The third type of value proposition, the Twitter pitch. And remember, the Twitter is a micro message of 140 or fewer characters. Brief, simple, and specific. Three of the fundamental rules of good writing. The mark of an effective tweet, like an effective pitch, is that it engages recipients and encourages them to take the conversation further. Further may be responding, sharing a tweet, clicking the link, or signing on for a seminar. What tweets do you think have the highest positive response rating? Readers assign the highest rating to tweets and the most response to tweets that ask questions. This confirms the power of questions to engage, to focus, to persuade. And remember, when you're deciding how to frame an offer or a service, no one will buy a method. How? What? A method. What theories? What systems you use? They won't buy a method. They will buy benefits. Now, let's think about listen to learn. Asking the right questions has more power than giving people the right answers. Appreciative inquiry, which is exactly what we do in coaching, can get much better results than seeking out and solving problems. Think of your preparation as having two parts or two steps, your purpose and your plan. Let's look a little bit more closely at your purpose. Three key questions will help you prepare your value proposition. You'll clarify your purpose by making sure that you can answer these three questions. What do you want them to know? What do you want them to feel? Remember, we do what we do because we imagine how we're going to feel when we do it. And three, what do you want them to do? What's the action step to take? So your plan, then, before you connect with a prospect, is to write down these four things. What would we talk about that would be the highest value objective for a client in the interaction? Secondly, what are two to three good questions to ask the prospect to resonate with their experience, their challenge? Three, if this discussion is successful, what's the next best action for that person and for me to take? And then fourth, maybe, if you have time, what are some additional possible topics for discussion? For most people, the opposite of talking isn't listening, it's waiting. When others speak, we usually divide our attention between what they're saying now and what we're going to say next, and the result is often a mediocre halfway position on both. Some professionals don't even bother to wait. A typical study found that physicians interrupt the majority of patients in the first 18 seconds that they begin to speak during an appointment. This often prevents the patients from describing what brought them into the office in the first place. In other words, telling their story. Now, here's an example of listening differently. Suppose you're raising money for a charity and you ask someone to contribute $200. She says, "Sorry, I can't give $200. Well, reframe that, consider it as an offer. Maybe she can donate a smaller amount. Or she might say, "No, I can't give right now." Well, consider that as an offer as well. Focus on the right now and ask when might be a better time. Or even consider framing the entire sentence as an offer, perhaps to contribute to your charity in some other way, such as being a volunteer. This way to hear responses as offers, which come in all shapes and sizes, is to reframe the way you listen and then change the way you respond. When both parties view an encounter as an opportunity to learn, the desire to sell or to win fades into the background. It becomes a different mindset of collaboration and engagement. When we move from selling to serving, we engage recipients as collaborators and become empathically attuned to their needs and to our effectiveness in meeting them. This non-salesy selling is the ability to influence, persuade, and change behavior while crafting a link between what others want and what you can provide them. We elicit from people what their specific goals are and frame what we can do to help them achieve those goals. So let's look at sales mastery now in terms of three phases: engage, enroll, and create conviction. And let's consider looking at it in a different sense from the mind and brain sciences. Each component, as the question at the beginning of this seminar, is based on knowing who your client is, the specific person you're about to engage in conversation, what their needs and their values are, what their identity is. So let's look more closely. One, to engage, to connect and create interest. Important to your story is your hero. Who's the hero of your story? Heroes come in all varieties: teller, listener, customer, product, location, tribe. The hero needs to fit the goal. The hero is the character in the story who gives the audience a point of view. All the passion in the world won't do any good unless we have some place to put it. That's where the hero comes in. The hero serves as guide and surrogate, the character that the reader or listener identifies with. Neuromarketing relies on activating a sense of identity with the product or service. If the audience experiences the story through the hero, and the story leads the hero to embrace a call to action, then your audience will automatically hear your call to action as well. The hero enables your audience to feel the change your story promises. In every story, there's an element that can make the difference. That's the hero, the character, the product, or brand the reader or viewer identifies with. Focus on the experience you deliver. Seminar 1 introduced how business and marketing stories like novels and films consist of three parts, recall. The challenge, the development, the resolution. The hero faces the challenge and develops it to the resolution. The hero may sometimes surprisingly be hard to pinpoint, but unless you do, you have no story. When people donate to a charitable cause, it's not some abstract notion to save the lives of tens of thousands of children, but the best story is how you can save one child. You can be the hero. For example, donation increased when moving from the abstract to the specific. When a famine in Ethiopia was substituted by a picture of Roika, a 7-year-old who faces a threat of severe hunger or even starvation. Donation immediately increased over 25%. How do you make your prospect the hero for your professional engagement? Ask, what do you want to achieve? Where would you ideally like to be in 1 year? And what constitutes an amazing achievement for you? Then you can know specifically how to help them get there. You need to know the single most important thing you could offer them. Remember, it's not about you, it's about them. It's not about method, it's about benefits. To find that single most important thing, there are 6 keys to preparation. This is in your outline. Know your prospect's challenges and needs. Know your own product and its specific advantages and benefits, because you're going to fit those two together. Know your competition, but never depreciate a competitor. Know the potential objections to have answers ready. We're going to go over those in just a bit. Expect the best. Have a state of positive anticipation, a state of mind of confidence. Create demand, ideally for the prospect to convince himself or herself. Remember, it's not what someone says in response to what you say, it's what they say to themselves in response to what you say that will make the difference. So, anchor yourself for success. Peak performance comes from being in a peak state. The hallmark of a true professional is the ability to manage a state of mind, as we discussed last time. So, 4 keys to effective engagement. Set specific goals. Be creative, playful, and fun. Again, from my favorite grandmother, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Have a plan for what you're going to say. And 4, do it in abundance to qualified contacts. You're most likely to stop yourself from making contact if you're not in a peak state, or believe that you're an interruption. To engage the prospect, connection and rapport are the foundation of all persuasion. Prospects will choose you because they trust you, like you, and especially because they have confidence in you. This confidence is the belief that you can help them get what they want or need. Importantly, they will choose you because they believe you have their best interest at heart. So, this is the answer to the Wharton School of Business quiz. The single factor that most determined whether someone engaged or declined professional services, the clarity and confidence of stating the recommendation and fee. States of mind, especially confidence, are contagious. Midbrain to midbrain, you will induce confidence in someone else by your confidence. Think of the recommendation that you got from the physician who was confident. Think of the recommendation you got from the physician who was not confident. You were probably out of there soon enough or didn't come back, even though it may have sounded a little bit differently, you didn't come back. The law of reciprocation, whatever you put out, it will come back manyfold, positive or negative. Caring people buy from caring people. They'll even help you close as long as you have the prospect's best interest in mind. People want to feel cared for. We all want to feel appreciated. So here are 3 psychological aspects for resonating and earning credibility. 1, you may need to argue against your own product or service. Indicate who the product or service is not for. It indicates you're not trying to sell to everybody, but a specific benefit for specific people. Secondly, which of these is more believable? About 60% of American households recycle regularly. 60.37% of American households recycle regularly. 78 of participants said the more specific number was more believable because it inferred accuracy. People believe precise numbers. When you make a claim, 3, when you make a claim, provide proof to back it up. Different forms of proof, if no scientific studies exist, statistics, personal stories, testimonials, research, professional, or media-given accolades. The second phase of sales mastery, enroll. Discover your prospects' needs and challenges. What are their needs, interests, and challenges? Their real problems that you can help them solve, that they will pay you money for. Highlight the problems and resonate with the pain. This is what the prospect may minimize or deny. Focus changes state of mind. What would be the best benefit to you of doing this? You're asking the client to provide the answers rather than telling them. When your question prompts someone to imagine, it becomes real for them. If you told them instead of asked them, they probably wouldn't believe you. Remember, facts and information are outside in. They're the prefrontal cortex. Those are not the decision-making areas. To enroll, do two things. Ask questions. This creates a focus, a canvas to paint a picture. Ask questions, and they'll get a real experience inside themselves and give real answers. Questions are the greatest asset. Questions empower you and the prospects by putting them in a state that makes things more congruent. And secondly, do something very real. Engage all five senses to give a full experience. Some of the highest paid people in this country are people who induce state changes. What sells is what puts someone in a better state, perhaps a hopeful or more optimistic state. Here's an exercise. And by the way, I hope each of you have noticed exercises at the end of the four seminars. And I'm interested if any of you have tried some of those, have done those, and if you find them helpful. We'll have a time to discuss that. But here's an additional exercise that I wanted to suggest verbally in person. Every night for seven nights, come up with three ideas about how you can get potential prospects to feel like they already own your product or service before they even buy it. Think of creative and unique ways to do that consistently. Or if your biorhythms are different, first thing in the morning. Now, most of the 21 that you come up with may seem sort of goofy, but you only need one or two to change your business. Here's an example of a real estate agent showing a house. The agent doesn't ask what you think about the living room, but instead ask where would you put your entertainment center. The agent wants to have the prospects experience it as if they already have bought it. One realtor's clients like a particular house they view, but they haven't decided. He then orchestrates an entire meal catered to this family in the home they're considering. They have a fabulous meal, see the fresh flowers he's brought in. They can picture themselves in their home. They don't even have to because they're there, and they're doing state-changing things of a meal. That house and experience become their story. The close rates of most realtors in the single digit, sometimes in the lower single digit. His close rate, 80%. If someone's eating food, they change their state, and the state links to the immediate anchor. That's why so much business is done at lunches and dinners, or the investment seminar at the steakhouse. This realtor changes the states of mind of the purchasers and linked pleasure and family togetherness with that house. He created a vivid Rorschach for the family to project their hopes and their excitement and made it real with all senses. Whatever's happening around someone, when they have a strong feeling, it will be linked, anchored. It's not logical. Is there any relationship between dog chow and a bell? Well, if they're coupled, Pavlov showed that a dog thought so. Pavlov's dog linked the bell with food and salivated, then only the bell was enough to cue the anticipation. What we associate to a stimulus determines our behavior. So put people in an environment that creates the state you want to link to your product. An example, I think, is the brilliant series of Super Bowl Budweiser commercials, The Dog and the Clydesdale, who are buddies. I love those. They induce a state of mind of connection and bonding and the release of oxytocin in the brain. Here's the best signal of a successful oxytocin release. Aw. the message goes right to your hippocampus to connect that experience with Budweiser. Another example, the new car smell that puts you in a state to buy a new car. BMW makes their brochures with that new car smell. I can verify that. The total sensory and emotional experience with the salesperson, that's you, matters. So get creative. Brainstorm. There's always a way to make it real and effective. Ask a question that will put people's minds on their challenge. Focus on the experience they're buying. If you had a seminar for your people, what would be the most important thing they'd get out of it? If you have three results, what would those best be? If you don't get those, what would it cost you? An example from one of my training program offerings. If your organization had an internal mentoring program, how would your people benefit? Especially if the mentors were trained in the mind and brain sciences of change, including conversational, social, and emotional intelligence. Ask questions, don't tell them. Ask how much more effectiveness or success would you have if you did this. Don't tell them, get them to tell you. The third phase of sales mastery, compel, create conviction. People don't buy facts or figures, they buy benefits for themselves. Selling is the transfer of emotion. For someone to buy, they must feel certain they will get what they want. Conviction starts with you first, then your client. But they have to buy or attend an event for their reasons, not yours. The number one way, give them the experience and conviction they will get what they want out of your product or service. The number two way, match to their number one value. For example, if it's freedom, show them how it's going to enhance their freedom. Find the dominant emotion for buying, even though the prospect will want to believe it's for logical reasons. We always buy for emotional reasons and then make it make sense in some logical way. Copywriters tell us there are five great motivators for marketing. One is fear. Life insurance people use this. One is exclusivity, to feel special or chosen. When narcissism goes shopping, a sense of specialness appeals, even creates a special bond, an exclusive offer, a private invitation. For example, Catherine, who asked the question, I put together this component of the seminar specifically for her. Three, greed. Although it has a negative connection and connotation, the true meaning of greed is a rapacious desire for more, to succeed massively, to make a difference. That's the positive benefit. Four, guilt. Nonprofits sometimes use this. And five, the need for approval. Product advertisements for cars and watches to fit with an identity people have or want to have. The task of sales involves the science of neuromarketing. The questions you ask people determine what they focus on. At any time, we're only focusing on a small band of data, what's available to us. The brain kind of works like a camera. You focus on a particular area. There's a whole lot of terrain out there, but you have to focus on a specific area. Brain does the same thing. We only see what we focus on. Do one benefit at a time, not the whole load. Our imagination is 10 times more powerful than our will. So make it real and assume the sale. When people don't buy, it's because they've linked buying with more pain than not buying. When they do buy, they link buying with more pleasure than not buying. So ask a question to focus on the benefit. And remember, again, people buy for emotional reasons and justify with logic. So let's look at objections and how to convert objections into commitment. So if someone has an objection, rather than counter or ignore or circumvent it, find out specifically what it is. Don't try to ignore it. An objection equates with getting more information. The best salespeople average 5 objections before a conversation, and they use each of these for further information of how to proceed. and be sure that an objection is not the projective voice of the seller, like you determining or assuming that someone's not going to be able to afford it. So, an objection is a question in disguise. An objection is an opportunity to do these three things. Hear the primary concern, because it crystallizes it so it can be addressed and reframed. Understand the person's belief or fear, and listen to the real question. So objections are signposts, your resources. A mistake would be to fight the objection. The key to influence is to align with the person, to get inside the circle with them. In spite of the fear, will it be a benefit greater if you do it? If the answer is yes in their gut, they're going to proceed. The best way to respond to an objection is to take each objection and interpret it as a question. So rather than a reason for not buying, hear it as a request for more information. You can't answer an objection, but you can answer a question. I can't afford it. Reframed. Please show me how I can afford it so it's worth it. Well, I have to talk it over with somebody else. Reframed. Please give me enough reasons I can go ahead and buy it without having to check and get someone else's opinion. Welcome an objection because it's information and a stepping stone to success. Treat an objection as powerful and important. Perhaps even compliment the person of having a good question because it allows both of you to think about it and consider it. So here are some considerations to convert objections into commitments. Don't engage the objection by countering it. Focus directs attention. Hear them out. Feed it back as a question. It puts the objection back to the questioner to examine it and explain it. Often when somebody tries to explain an objection, they may withdraw it. Get more objection. Is this the real objection? Get more information, rather. Is this the real objection? Align with the prospect to collaborate. In a collaboration, you're on the same side. You're both in the circle. If you fight an objection, you're outside the circle. It will limit you. So instead of countering the question or the objection, which is going to entrench someone more, align with it. I appreciate or respect how you feel about that. Or it is an expensive investment, and I believe you'll have an exponential return on your investment. Turn the objection into a question. Reframe it. Questions are the genesis of focus. And again, you can't answer an objection, but you can answer a question. Well, it seems the real question is, can you get enough value to warrant buying? Or it sounds like a concern is how you can get benefits now. Focus on the benefit, not the concern. For example, if there's an issue with expense, reframe about it. Brag it. About it. Do it up front. Assume the sale. The best persuaders assume the sale. Congratulate them on a wise decision rather than thanking them for the sale. So, the last thing I want to talk about and then open it for discussion is the psychology of closing. This is the point that both parties likely hate the most. So, do the close as quickly and painlessly as possible. It's also the most effective way. A man had a painful tooth that he knew needed to be extracted. He called his dentist, whose patient he'd been for a long time. The two knew each other really well. He asked the dentist how much he would charge him to extract a tooth and how long it would take. The dentist said, well, I'll charge you $185 and it'll only take a minute. The man responded, only a minute? That's a lot of money for just a minute. The dentist responded, well, if time is an issue, I can take as long as you want. Have your closings planned in advance, word for word, but sound natural and spontaneous like you talking, not like reading a script. Major aspects for closing. Engage a positive, enthusiastic mindset. Clarify the client's requirements. Help the client briefly, clearly, simply understand what you're offering. And this is in a framework of rapport and friendship and trust. Focus on the benefit the client will get. Again, not in a salesy way, but just a simple, elegant statement, 10 words or less. Match the product or service to the prospect. This should be throughout. So four aspects here in summary. Prospects must want it, need it, afford it, and use it. So here's a reminder of a model that we discussed in seminar one. Recommend your professional services clearly and succinctly in three sentences following the three-story structure component: challenge, development, resolution. Summarize the client's challenge. That's the challenge part. How you can help the development. Recommend, for example, mentor coaching, framework, and fee. That's the resolution. That's three sentences. That's not a paragraph. That's not a bunch of paragraphs. Remember, the hero is the person, the place, the product, or the brand that enables someone to feel the change the story promises. So how can you make your client the hero of her story or his story? Make it easy and create a future. Create a relationship that lasts through the years. This is the most important thing of anything that you do. The most important part of the engagement is to give more than is expected, to generate an ongoing relationship. To prevent buyer's remorse, look at future pacing. Future pace includes every time someone purchases, help them imagine themselves in the future, how they're going to use the product or service in the future a year from now. What will you be doing with this training that will make you glad you've done it? Link something present to your product. For example, I build this into my training of mentor coaches. For example, the New Money Story Mentor Training begins next week. Having a mentor group every quarter and a white paper every quarter where we share success stories and mastermind challenges. They attend my teleseminar. Some are on this teleseminar without charge and are on a registry for referrals. I want it to be a professional family for each to be really successful. For corporate mentoring programs, after the training, a monthly group teleconference for 12 months with white papers or webinars, each around a specific continuing learning topic. Offer more than someone expects. Give them a reason to buy. Theirs, not yours, emotional and logical. People will put off buying if they can, so build in units of conviction. Make it fun. Again, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Have I said that before? So here's in summary, a brief summary of the strategies of successful people, of top sellers. And these are six in summary. Enter your optimum state for the task. Reset after the last experience. This is a number one quality. Prepare yourself physically and emotionally in an optimum performance state. Two, qualify prospects. Find their deepest needs, the core emotional need that drives the person, their challenge, their pain point. Then teach them how to get it through what you offer. Three, manage the prospect's state. Four, give prospects a way to justify buying to satisfy a need. Five, remain flexible. The person most flexible controls the situation. So to be successful, know the outcome, take action, know what getting closer and what getting farther away both look like, and change your approach until you get what will really most benefit your prospect. And six, become a team player. Consistently attuned to the prospect's needs. Is there more value than the concern they bring? Create and sustain interest. Build trust and rapport continuously. And finally, imagine inventing a device that can record memories, dreams, ideas, and transmit them to your brain. This device, this game-changing technology, is at the center of influence, persuasion, mindset mastery, and neuromarketing. This game-changing technology is called storytelling. We're in discussion mode now, if you'll manage the background noise. Any thoughts, comments, questions, or things that you'd like to discuss a bit more? Thank you all for your participation. It's been a real privilege working with you and putting together some ideas, responding to some of the emails that you've sent. It's been a real honor doing this with you. So thoughts or questions? We still have 4 or 5 minutes. What you got? Is there anything that you immediately think of that you consider a change of how you're thinking or doing that's based on what we've talked about? What's the one biggest thing that you're thinking or doing differently based on what we've discussed during these seminars? Anyone?
I would say storytelling would be the best tip that I took away from this.
Okay. Great. It's how we remember, how we understand things, how we convey, and how we influence. You know, and think about those of you who have attended as well as do retreats, workshops. The things that you probably most remember are the stories. And I've mentioned in another context, this is one of the first things that I did when I made a transition to mentor coaching, is engage a mentor who really focused on and specialized in storytelling. And he told me a story of one day he was doing a workshop in Chicago, and someone stopped him in the airport in O'Hare and said, "I just wanted to tell you, Doug, that I attended a presentation you did 4 years ago, and I want you to know how important that was to me and how much it made a difference." And he said, "Well, I appreciate that. Would you remind me what I talked about?" And she said, "Oh, I don't remember what you talked about, but I'll always remember that story you told me." So this is how we make sense of things, understand, and remember. Create and collect stories. Make it into stories. Look at any, you know, any bricks and mortar bookstore, go to the nonfiction section, pull off any book. Chapter one is going to be a story. It's going to engage the reader, and a story engages both sides of the brain, the emotional side, and then to understand what it's about, the points and the benefits, that's the left side. It's balanced learning. So develop your storytelling. So thank you for that. Other responses. What's the one thing?
I thought some of the comments you made about changes in state, like linking food with a presentation, that was really interesting to think about different states.
Okay.
And how to consciously shift those states.
Yes. Yeah, that's the I believe the most important success factor that we have is regulation of states of mind and managing states of mind. Two resources here. One is on the homepage of my website, MentorPath, there's a 35-minute webinar simply called Master States of Mind. I think it would be beneficial. You just, you know, it's free. You just click on it. You can't miss it. It's dead center. Another thing I want to mention, since you mentioned this, I had actually planned to mention this anyhow. I'm doing another teleseminar series through CTA beginning actually next Monday, so we can meet back same time, same place. It's a teleseminar series. It's the first time I've offered it through CTA, called Stress Mastery and Peak Performance. It's a four-part seminar series. I have worked a good deal with pro athletes and actors, but I am doing research and writing now of a training program, a book, a workbook on optimizing performance and attaining and sustaining peak performance. And I'm going to present a synopsis of what will later unfold as a book and a training for licensed specialty certification. So it will give you a good idea. It will be much like this. It's a lot of information, not a whole lot of discussion time, But there's a wealth of information I think will make a major difference for you in your own professional and personal performance, as well as helping clients attain and really sustain a peak performance in what they do. Now, I didn't mean to mention this and try to do an upsell here, but I did want to mention it based on discussion. So time for one other response. What's the major thing that you got out of this?
Hi,
that I worked
Catherine again.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
That our confidence, we need to be clear on who we are, what we are offering, because in that way we will project that confidence and the clients will be attracted to that confidence as well. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you very much. And the other person who spoke.
Hi, it's Catherine. I agree with the storytelling, but also it weaves all the way through it, our relationships. This is really about relationships and having fun. I love that. Have fun.
Okay.
So hearing that over and over again.
Super. Thank you all very much for your participation, energy, feedback. I hope this was beneficial. If you have other thoughts or questions, you know how to reach me. You have my email, so don't hesitate to contact me if I can be of help to you. So thanks very, very much. It was a total privilege doing this and very enjoyable. So
thank
to be
you.
Continued.
Thank you.
Bye,
thank
bye
you.
Now.
Thank
Thanks.
You. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye.